KALW. From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Inner Richmond, Lower Haight,
Burlingame,
Mission,
Potrero Hill.
Coming up, are San Francisco police officers discouraging drug users from getting clean needles?
As an IV drug user, most IV drug users know the needle exchange is essential. If we don't use the needle exchange, we contract diseases and we die.
Then lawmakers push legislation to ease California's housing crisis.
The really controversial piece would streamline the approval process for building new apartments and condominiums.
And a storyteller keeps creativity alive in San Francisco.
I try to create opportunities for fellow artists to remind them that this city can be a great place for artists.
That's coming up on Cross Currents. Stay with us. President Trump spoke out about the nation's problem with opioids earlier this month.
The opioid crisis is an emergency, and I'm saying officially right now, it is an emergency. It's a national emergency. We're going to spend a lot of time, a lot of effort, and a lot of money on the opioid crisis.
The president made that proclamation, but he never took the legal steps necessary to actually make it a national emergency. On the same day, though, a San Francisco task force suggested creating medically supervised places to shoot up. If and when they open, they could be the first in the nation, and they'd continue a tradition of the city supporting harm reduction efforts for people addicted to drugs. Back in the 1980s, San Francisco was a pioneer in needle exchanges. But there may be some mixed messages being sent at a syringe access program in the Haight-Ashbury neighborhood. Police officers often hang out near the building's entrance. That can discourage people who use drugs from getting clean needles, and it might be in violation of the department's own guidelines. KALW's Andy Bosselman reports.
Since the summer of love 50 years ago, thousands of young people have been showing up every year in San Francisco's Haight-Ashbury district, many with no plan for housing. Today, street kids still hang out on the sidewalks, often wearing flowing hippie dresses, dreadlocks, or punk mohawks. The neighborhood is also known for its drug culture. In recent years, the opioid epidemic has grown the number of people who inject drugs. Audra Muse, she used to be one of those kids on the street.
I'm 35 years old. I started using IV drugs when I was 18. I used for about 13 years of active addiction with heroin, crack, meth. I'm a multiple felon. I have 2.5 years clean today, actually.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Muse says she had a hard time fitting in high school, and she started using to cope. She idolized writers and punk musicians, many known for their drug use. When she got onto the streets of San Francisco,
we had this little gang of roaming punk rockers, and we all kind of looked out for each other.
Muse also received some acceptance, some care, and some clean needles from the people who work at the Homeless Youth Alliance, or HYA. It's a nonprofit run by Mary Howe.
We get to know people on a really deep level, and like many people are accessing the staff for just support or referrals or other supplies or to get naloxone so they can save a loved one's life.
San Francisco's Department of Public Health supports the city's syringe access programs. That's because clean needles help cut down on the number of HIV and hepatitis C infections, two diseases that drug users often contract and can be passed along to others in the community. Many programs like this provide basic health care too, and that reduces expensive ambulance calls and emergency room visits. Here's Muse again.
So needle exchange is essential. As an IV drug user, most IV drug users know the needle exchange is essential. If we don't use the needle exchange, we contract diseases and we die.
And these programs work. Since 2012, even as the opioid epidemic and injection drug use has surged, the number of injectors who contract HIV in San Francisco has remained about the same. But that progress may be under threat by the actions of another branch of city government, the San Francisco Police Department. Let's go to the syringe access program in the Hay.
Thank you so much.
Hey, hi guys.
Going up if you need anything today?
The needle program meets 3 nights a week. And if you walk by, you might notice someone sitting on the steps while holding a sign. On July 26th, that person was a volunteer named Hannah Horowitz. When I got there, she told me what she just saw.
Two police officers were standing across the street, and they talked to a man who was sitting against the wall and had him move on, and they stayed across the street.
The cops were there for about half an hour. And after those officers left, it wasn't over.
And then 10 minutes later, two different officers pulled up and stayed parked there for about 5-10 minutes until Mary Howe went and talked to them.
Do you see that as problematic?
Yes, I think they're trying to intimidate the people that would otherwise be able to freely come into our exchange.
There's some research to back up Horowitz. Several studies have found that when people who use drugs are searched, arrested, or if they just see police conducting surveillance near a needle program, many will stay away. Researchers in the U.S. and globally found that police encounters led to increased risk of HIV and behaviors like sharing syringes. But for cops, needle programs can be seen as easy fishing, meaning they're a good place to find people to lock up. People on probation, on parole, with warrants, or in possession of illegal drugs. Here's Audra Muse again.
I had a warrant most of the time, so seeing a cop outside of the needle exchange was incredibly discouraging.
And the San Francisco Police Department knows that their presence can be counterproductive. Back in January, the SFPD issued its latest bulletin about syringe access programs. It states that officers should use discretion and try not to interfere with the programs. Right now, I'm directly across the street from the syringe access program in The Hague. This is one of the spots where foot patrol officers conduct surveillance, sometimes for half an hour, sometimes for a lot longer. So I started making observations. I did that over 28 nights. The needle program met for 14 of them. And half of those nights, 7 total, there were foot patrol officers hanging out within eyeshot of the clinic. And what about the other 14 nights? When the program did not meet, it was 0. There was not one night with that kind of police presence. Now, if you're not a homeless drug user, a handful of foot patrol officers hanging out nearby may not sound like a big problem. But for Muse,
as a drug user trying to go and get a service, which first of all isn't easy to do, seeing the police outside of a needle exchange is an extreme deterrent.
Yet some neighbors want the police there. Lena Emery has lived in the neighborhood for 30 years, and she knows the intersection near the needle program.
I don't go there because it's too scary.
Yeah.
I mean, I'll go to the post office, but only at 10 a.m. in the morning when I'm not subject to harassment and people trying to sell me dope.
Bill Scott, San Francisco's new police chief, says he's working to strike a balance.
I understand and I fully support, as chief of police, the reasons for, you know, the needle exchanges. We're trying to keep people safe and keep people alive. I get that. However, there's a larger public safety issue that we also need to be concerned about.
As for the police department's bulletin, it seems to imply that officers should steer clear of the needle program. I asked the chief, why aren't cops avoiding the area?
And I don't think it's a sound policy in any stretch of imagination to say, you know, police officers can't be at any location because you might have an emergency that requires us to be there.
The chief's stated support of syringe access programs is important at this moment because a task force the city brought together just recommended something new, safe injection sites. If built, they would be places where medical professionals supervise people when they shoot up. Those facilities could also become targets of policing that drives away drug users.
I think we have to hear from all sides, and then we have to decide on what's in the best interest of the whole.
With that input, the mayor and board of supervisors can consider some changes. They could have the police commission issue an official policy around existing and future needle programs. That would be more authoritative than the current bulletin. Similar to other cities, San Francisco's policy could include clearly defined discretionary zones, places policed less aggressively during operating hours. And some advocates say that officers shouldn't just be incentivized for locking people up. Cops should also be rewarded for helping people who use drugs, like Audra Muse.
As hopeless as we are, I still believe that most of us have the smallest spark inside of us that believes that one day there's a very, 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 very slim possibility that we might get clean and do something with our lives.
During her 13 years as a drug user, Muse ended up using dirty needles. She contracted hepatitis C, which she now has under control. But with different policies in place, Muse may never have contracted hepatitis. She may have spent less time in jail, and she might have gotten her life back together sooner. Today, with 2.5 years clean, she's healthy and strong. She looks great.
I am currently employed with 2 jobs instead of multiple felonies, and I have an 11-month-old son.
There are hundreds of thousands of people like Muse. In San Francisco alone, it's estimated there are more than 20,000 people who inject drugs. Getting the police and public health providers on the same page could determine just how long the country's opioid epidemic will last. For Cross Currents, I'm Andy Bosselman.
This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. After failing to make a deal last year, state legislators and Governor Brown vowed to do something to address the state's housing crisis, and they just might do it this week. 3 housing bills are being considered, and decisions could come by Friday. I'm joined now by KALW's housing reporter Liza Veal to talk about what's at stake. So what is happening in Sacramento, Liza?
It is really coming down to the wire right now on this housing deal. A bunch of big city California mayors went to Sacramento today to just urge lawmakers to get all 3 passed. Mm-hmm. So there's 2 bills to fund affordable housing, and then a 3rd bill, the really controversial piece, would streamline the approval process for building new apartments and condominiums. So it eases the regulations there. Mm-hmm. And assuming that all Republicans vote no, every Democrat would have to vote yes on all 3 bills. So basically what's happening is the more progressive-aligned Democrats are saying to the more business-aligned Democrats, okay, we'll sign off on your streamlining plan if you get on board with spending more on low-income housing.
You scratch my back, I'll scratch yours.
Exactly.
So what are the details of these bills?
So SB3 puts a $4 billion affordable housing bond on the ballot. So we, the voters, will be voting for that in 2018.
Okay.
SB4 would create a new permanent $75 fee on all real estate transactions in order to raise money for affordable housing projects. Mm-hmm. So in other words, property owners, including first-time home buyers, would be helping to raise money for people that are housing insecure. Mm. And then if passed, these 2 funding sources would create an estimated 70,000 new units.
Okay, so that's the first 2. What about the 3rd bill, the one streamlining development?
This is Scott Wiener's bill, the former supervisor of San Francisco. And the way SB 35 works is if a proposal for a new building meets certain requirements, like local zoning, affordability quotas, then it's just automatically approved. It's just streamlined for construction.
Because
the way that it works now is projects are put before a community engagement process and planning reviews, and supporters of SB 35 say that part of the process gets so drawn out, is so costly, that it's the main reason that we have a housing shortage at all. So they want to help builders just circumvent that process.
Make it faster. So why then is that controversial?
Well, tenants' rights groups oppose it because that whole review and debate process, it's really been a crucial tool that they use to demand community benefits, like, you know, more affordable units, good local jobs programs, health clinics, all these things to try to offset displacement.
Okay, so, and then what about those who support it? What do they say about that?
Well, to some, the upside is that SB 35, I mean, it also applies to the affordable housing projects. And there are plenty of neighborhoods that try to block those developments, and SB 35 will just override them as well.
Right.
I mean, and then there's also the idea that just adding any supply at all, even if it's fancy new luxury condos, it helps relieve some of the demand for the existing housing. And that even that new housing in a few decades will be more affordable, it'll depreciate. And so just adding supply is good. I mean, in the meantime, it's a really big boon to developers and the business interests. But, you know, since there's no political will for funding a big government housing program, this is the course that California is taking as a solution.
All right. So overall, they're looking at this in terms of solving the overall housing problem. But then local neighborhoods worry about losing that local control.
Yeah, it's like regionally versus, because the thing is that new construction does cause displacement. It does change neighborhoods. And that community engagement process has been a really effective tool for trying to make up for that and try to ease the disruption. And so this bill is really especially contentious in cities and in gentrifying neighborhoods. I mean, it's interesting, like reading the registered, you know, the official support and opposition for this state bill, the majority of the organizations and the people on the list are actually San Francisco people. So the whole state will feel this, but the strongest reactions are probably going to come from Wiener's hometown.
That's KALW's housing reporter, Liza Veal. If you've got a housing or homelessness issue you'd like to tell her about, email housing@kalw.org. This is Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. Writer and performer Baruch Porras Hernandez is a busy man. He hosts the Shipwreck Fan Fiction Competition and podcast in San Francisco. He founded the Latinx performer showcase Donde Está Mi Gente, and he performs regularly with The Moth, Radar Productions, and Literary Deathmatch. He spoke with KALW's Jen Sheehan about what it means for him to make it as a writer and a queer artist in the Bay Area. We'll start with an excerpt from one of his poems.
As a gay man, it's good to have goals. Goal number two, lose 150 pounds. Get a spiky gay haircut with frosted tips. Wear nothing but shorts and polo shirts. Call all my male friends bro. Ignore all women. Only talk to men if we are talking about how to make money. Buy a giant house after displacing poor people. Never use it. Kick brown children off soccer fields. Slut shame men who are in open relationships. Make fun of the word polyamory, but have anonymous sex at the gym. Go to Burning Man. Go to Burning Man, bro. Go to Burning Man, bro. Go to Burning Man, bro. Wait, bro, you don't go? You don't go? Why? Why? Why not? Go to Burning Man, bro. Why don't you go? It's too expensive? Make more money, bro. But bro, really, bro, you should go. It's such a spiritual experience.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Can you talk about where that poem comes from for you? I hear a little bit of, well, I hear a little satire, I hear a little anger, but I also hear affection and, you know, a sense of identification.
Yeah, I feel like I wrote it a while ago when I was trying to figure out, I guess, how to make it just as like a person. Not even just as an artist, but I feel like in my late 20s in San Francisco, I wanted to just make it. And everybody thought I was trying to make it as, like, become famous. And I kept having to correct people and say, no, I don't want to get famous. I want to just have a house. And I want to be able to help my parents out. So I tried to, like, talk to older gay men who I thought seemed had made it or who had a lot of security. And they kept telling me, like, well, you know, you have to have goals.
And it seemed like they were really just telling me you have to have money. You know, they were trying to say, like, make more money.
Mm-hmm. That was in order to do all of those things.
In order to do well. So, yeah, I feel the poem was coming from some sort of like, how the heck do I survive in this city and without always panicking like I'm going to lose my place to live? Like, my parents are old now. What if something happens to them? What if my partner gets run over?
These are real things that, especially as you get older, they become more important.
Especially if you're making sacrifices to continue working as an artist, it's something that always kind of, I feel, weighs heavily on you because there's so much, I feel, artistic guilt with that. Like, well, I'm not diving into like a very lucrative career to have all the security and stay in the Bay Area. So there's that level of guilt. And then you throw in immigrant guilt, and it's just a guilt party. It's just a let's eat a whole pizza and cry guilt party, you know?
I'm wondering what makes you stay? What has kept you here? And what has kept you in the artistic life?
I feel what's kept me here is, well, I used to run a show called the San Francisco Queer Open Mic. And every month we would do this show, and the community would come, and they all seemed very exhausted. Most of them were queer.
You mean your audiences?
The audience. A bunch of them were trans folks. And they just all had people of color. They had this look on their face that they were happy to be there. But they were, like, exhausted from trying to survive in San Francisco and this really expensive city. Half of them didn't even live here. Half of them would come from the East Bay or the outskirts of the Bay Area because it was so important for them to be around other queer artists like them. And then all of the magic that was shared on stage would just totally, like, you know, breathe kind of new life into the co-host and I. And I could see it working with the other folks in the audience. Like, people would leave uplifted and people would leave really just recharged, I feel. I love how diverse it is here. I feel when I perform in other cities, it's not the same mix of folks that I see here in San Francisco. And I really like that. I really like that there's also like a network of artists that have helped me grow a lot. That's one of the things that keep me here. People like Kevin Seaman have helped me grow a ton as an artist. Beatrice Al Thomas, she's also an local drag queen named Black Benatar. And whenever I have the opportunity, I try to create opportunities for fellow artists to remind them that this city can be a great place for artists. And it has been for a lot of artists, even though a lot of artists are struggling here. Great things do happen here. So whenever I organize a show, I try to make sure the artists get paid. I make sure that we're promoted well. I make sure to work with artists that are doing super well. And also artists I think are great and maybe haven't had as many opportunities as I have.
So you just got a grant to do a project around queer and Latinx superhero stories. So first, congratulations.
Yeah, thank you.
And can you explain a little bit about what this project is?
I've been reading X-Men since I was 10 or 12. They've always been a huge part of my life. They helped me when I was in the closet. They helped me when I was coming out of the closet. One thing I noticed is that to this day, there isn't a Mexican or Latino character that's become part of the main roster. I could be wrong. I hope people don't freak out if I'm wrong. I know Velocidad was an official X-Men for a while. Anyway, the project is I'm working with MACLA, who is they're an incredible organization. They've been around forever in San Jose. They focus on Mexican, Chicano, Latinx artists. I'm going to gather some Latino writers, and I'm going to write new queer Latino superheroes. And they're going to be poems, short stories. And then we're going to take those stories, and we're going to give them to some artists, and they're going to create comic books. And then we're going to perform them in front of a live audience. So kind of like a radio play, but you can see the comic book. We're going to, like, read it to the audience.
With the visuals that the artists have created.
Some voice actors or maybe literary performers. There's a ton of writers that are also performers like me, so I'm hoping to find them to, you know, read the story out to folks. And I want people to come dressed as their favorite superhero. It doesn't have to be a Latino superhero. But, you know, I'm hoping that this will get all the people of color nerds over to San Jose so they can celebrate with us.
That's writer and performer Baruch Porras Hernandez speaking with KLW's Jen Chien. He's bringing his Latinx performer showcase, Donde Está Mi Gente, to the Beast Crawl Literary Festival. That's this Saturday at the New Parkway Theater in Oakland. All the details are at KLW.org. Click Cross Currents. That's all for us today. The Cross Currents team includes Raquel Maria Dillon, Nina Gensler-Debs, Lisa Morehouse, Stephen Short, Jackie Sajiko, Andrew Stelzer, and Laura Wenis. Our engineers are Gabe Graben and James Rollins. The line producer is Hannah Kingsley Ma. Our managing editor is Jen Chien. Ben Trefney is our news director. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. Today's local music is by Bay Area musician Chuck Prophet. He'll be joined by Maurice Tanney on Sunday at Rancho Nicasio in Nicasio, California. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba. Well, the thin white Duke took a final bow. There's one more star in the heavens now. The moon won't rise, the sun won't set.